Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter John Carreyrou. Carreyrou was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal for 20 years and won two Pulitzers for the journal's coverage of the corporate scandals in the early 2000s and Medicare fraud that was unmasked in 2014. He also won a Polk Award more recently for his coverage of the medical tech company Theranos and its charismatic 31-year-old CEO, Elizabeth Holmes. The company purported to create a device that would revolutionize blood testing, utilizing just a few drops of blood, but was found to be a sham. At its peak, Theranos had a market value of $10 billion, and its flawed prototype was actually in a market testing phase in California and Arizona, taking actual blood from patients, before Carreyrou helped expose the fraud. Holmes and company president Sonny Balwani settled fraud charges with the Security and Exchange Commission and are under criminal indictment in federal court for wire fraud and conspiracy charges. Carreyrou's reporting on the company became the basis of his book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. The book was published in late 2018 to wide acclaim and is now out in softcover. His reporting is also the basis of a documentary film and purportedly a feature film. He'll be in Tulsa this Saturday at 2 o'clock at OU Tulsa in a ticketed event from Magic City Books and Booksmart Tulsa. You can learn more at magiccitybooks.com. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. John Carreyrou, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bad Blood tells the story of CEO Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And really, this is an old story in a 21st century setting. A charismatic leader and person selling something that's too good to be true, and a willing audience ready to suspend disbelief. In this case, a medical device that could revolutionize blood testing. Tell us a little bit about Elizabeth Holmes and how she was able to build Theranos without being able to deliver any sort of working product.
Right. She was a 19-year-old sophomore when she dropped out of Stanford back in 2004 and launched her company, and she had this vision for a device. At first, it was a bracelet-like device that was going to take minute amounts of your blood from your wrist and then diagnose whatever ailed you and administer the appropriate drug. And after a few months, she and her co-founder realized that this vision was actually more science fiction than reality, so they downgraded it to something they thought would be more realistic. But the common thread during those 12, 15 years of the company's existence is that the vision, her vision, was always too ambitious for what they were able to actually do. They never were able to implement her vision. And the problem is that she never was willing to acknowledge to herself or to her investors, board members, to the public, that they failed in living up to her expectations and that they failed in implementing the vision. And so that led to a situation where come 2013, 14, 2015, she was still telling people that she had a technology that worked, that could do hundreds of tests off of a pinprick of blood, a prick from the finger. And in fact, she had no such thing. She had several prototypes that had never really worked. The last one was called the Mini Lab. And so there was this big gap between what she was telling people and what the reality was. And ultimately, the gap grew bigger and bigger, and the gap amounted to fraud. And that's the reason why she's going to be tried this summer.
Yeah. And this was not a matter of showing that this thing worked for investors or for potential clients. This was a device that was actually being used on the public. For the last couple of years of this company's existence, taking blood and providing results that may or may not have any connection with reality.
Right. What they did is they were running out of money in mid-2013, and she had also been telling Walgreens, her retail partner, that she had this product and then dragging her feet for years. So she felt under pressure to launch with a technology that wasn't ready. And what they did is they hacked a traditional blood analyzer made by the German company Siemens. They modified it to try to create this illusion that their technology worked. And then on the basis of that commercial launch, which was first in two Walgreens stores in Northern California in late 2013, and then in 40 more Walgreens stores in the Phoenix area in 2014, based on that launch, she went to investors and solicited more money and got about $800 million of funding thereafter. So that's where it became securities fraud. She went to investors in late 2013, early 2014, with the lie that she had a product that she had fine-tuned and that worked, and the money came pouring in. That's one part of the fraud. The other part of the fraud is that she lied to patients and to doctors and to the public, and Theranos, you know, returned to patients and doctors blood test results that were often faulty and wrong, causing all sorts of problems from, you know, misdiagnosis to wrong diagnoses. So and it's important to note that, because that's going to be part of what's at stake at the trial. Prosecutors have charged Elizabeth and Sonny Balwani, her ex-boyfriend, who used to be the number two of the company, with not just securities fraud. They have also charged them with perpetrating a fraud on patients and doctors.
Right. And so take us back to this big idea. The big idea was that this was not going to just test glucose or even cholesterol. This was going to do like the work of a whole blood routine that you would normally go to a lab to take a sizable amount of blood to test, right?
Right. The phrase that she used and that Theranos used on its website was the full range of laboratory tests, which usually is understood to mean several hundred. And on its menu, Theranos had about 250 tests. And so, yes, it was supposed to be much more than just one or two discrete tests. The problem is that her machine could not do all those tests. At best, the device that they had, one of the devices that they had, was called the Edison, named after Thomas Edison, could do about six blood tests. And then they had the Siemens machine, which they modified and hacked, that they used for another 80 or 90 tests to try to maintain this illusion that their technology worked.
And in the meantime, they're talking with doctors that are looking at giving their patients, they're giving them like cancer drugs. And so this calls for very sensitive blood testing to test liver function, kidney function, and the like. And I mean, this could have been a real tragedy. Do we know if there were any deaths related to this?
I don't know. I can't say. I didn't come across any deaths in my reporting. I can't say with absolute certainty that no deaths were caused. I came across more than a dozen examples of people who had health scares because of erroneous blood test results. People, some of whom, you know, got on treatments that they didn't need, and then had their health altered by these unnecessary treatments. But the thing to remember is that this experimentation on patients was thankfully stopped still in its early days, because when I came along and my story was published in October, my first investigative piece on Theranos was published in mid-October of 2015. They had only rolled out the partnership with Walgreens in about 42 stores, two in California and another 40 in the Phoenix area. And the plan, the next step of the partnership, was to expand the partnership nationally to Walgreens' 8,000 other stores across the country. Thankfully, that did not happen. You can imagine what a disaster that would have been.
Now, how does a Stanford sophomore dropout, chemical engineer, who comes up with this big idea, I guess this is just not a new story in Silicon Valley, so she was able to attract capital to her idea pretty early?
Right. Early on, she was able to get a million-dollar check from Tim Draper, who was kind of a friend of the family. Her family had lived next door to Tim Draper, who's a well-known Silicon Valley venture capitalist in the late 80s, early 90s. She had befriended Tim Draper's daughter. And when she dropped out of Stanford some years later, she was able to approach him and get a $1 million check. And then once Draper was on board, it became a little bit easier to get other people to give her money too. Another person that she was able to charm early on and wow with sort of her precociousness was Don Lucas, who's a well-known Silicon Valley venture capitalist who groomed Larry Ellison for a while, was the chairman of the board of Oracle, helped Larry Ellison take Oracle public back in the 80s. And when Don Lucas met Elizabeth Holmes, he thought he had met the second coming of Larry Ellison, except as a woman. So she benefited from these big, bold names early on. And then the point at which she really raised the most money is about a decade into the life of the company, when she was actually running out of money, and she decided to go live with what was essentially a fake product. And then based on the fact that the product was live, that it was available in Walgreens stores, she was able to solicit $800 million more dollars in funding from the likes of Betsy DeVos, our Secretary of Education, from the likes of members of the Walton family, from the likes of Rupert Murdoch, who, by the way, controls the parent company of the Wall Street Journal.
Right, right. And I think there was at some point an effort to convince Rupert Murdoch to intervene on your stories, right?
That's right. Yep, she met with Murdoch several times and tried to prevail on him to halt my investigation, and thankfully he did not.
So obviously Elizabeth Holmes was a very charismatic salesperson in selling this idea, but I guess it's the idea of itself that really interested investors. This, you know, how many times do we have to stop what we're doing, go to a lab to have blood drawn? It's never a quick and easy process. It's pain, you know, can have pain involved. And the idea of just a little pinprick that would tell your doctor this information, this was an appealing idea to a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very seductive idea. The idea that you could get just a blood or two pricked from your finger, relatively painless and user-friendly, and then get fast results. The guaranteed results within a few hours. And in fact, her pitch was that because the process was so painless and user-friendly, patients would get their blood tested more often than they did currently. And as a result, illnesses would get diagnosed earlier and lives would be saved because those illnesses would be treated at an earlier stage. And so she often spoke about saving lives with her technology. And anytime you're telling the public and investors, for that matter, that you're going to be saving lives with a brand new product, that's a powerful pitch.
And there was also another element that you write about, is that tech wanted her to succeed, to be a female mogul that had built their own company, a female Bill Gates, Steve Jobs.
Absolutely. There was this yearning in Silicon Valley for a woman to succeed on the scale that these men had, the Steve Jobses, the Bill Gateses, Larry Ellison, the Larry Page, Sergey Brin, Mark Zuckerberg. You'll notice all those guys were guys. And this was going to be the first woman to succeed on their level and to become as wealthy as they were. The highest valuation for Theranos was reached in 2015, and it was $10 billion. And Elizabeth Holmes had managed to keep half of the equity in the company, so she was worth about $5 billion. She was going to be the first woman, self-made female tech billionaire. And all of Silicon Valley was rooting for her, and I think this was much larger than Silicon Valley. You had women all over the country and the world rooting for her. You had little girls writing her letters and emails, and it was really inspiring that she was going to burst through that glass ceiling in Silicon Valley.
My guest today is John Carreyrou, a 20-year veteran reporter for the Wall Street Journal, won the Pulitzer Prize two times, and his reporting on Theranos won a Polk Award and resulted in the book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. It's now out in softcover by Vintage Paperbacks, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, as much as it was a story of her selling this technology that doesn't work, it's also a story of a board who doesn't do their job. The warning signs were already in place in 2006 when the first CFO just is one day there and one day gone, and that comes after a trip to Switzerland to talk about this product, and it doesn't work, and there's, you know, excuses made. But the turnover at the company was rampant. Board members who questioned the rosy financial projections, the production delays, were told to resign. This is a story of a board who just really bought into this vision and into this leadership and didn't want to hear anything else.
Right. There were two moments in the early years of the company where people at the level of the board asked questions. One was in late 2007, when a pretty well-known Silicon Valley figure named Avi Tavanian, who had worked for a long time at Apple with Steve Jobs, he had retired, and he, in retirement, had been approached by a headhunting firm and had agreed to become a board member of Theranos. And within a year of sitting on that board, he realized that things were not right, and he tried to blow the whistle and tried to get the board to do something. And the chairman of the board at the time, Don Lucas, asked him to leave quietly. And then a few months later, about 6 months later, there was an employee who also tried to blow the whistle and raise alarm bells with the board. And he convinced the general counsel of the company at the time that things weren't right. And that those two people went together again to the chairman of the board, Don Lucas. And again, that was handled quietly. There was a brief moment where the board almost unseated her and put someone else as CEO, but she managed to turn the situation around and to persuade them not to do that. And then from that point forward, her credibility was never questioned again. And the latter years of the company, she assembled this unbelievable board with ex-statesmen like Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, who'd both been Secretary of State. Jim Mattis, former Secretary of Defense, was on that board. Sam Nunn, other big names who had you know, larger than life careers in government, but that was actually a red flag. Looking back, none of them really had any experience in medicine, and certainly no expertise in blood diagnostics. And so, when you look back at board, which was impressive at first glance, was actually a big red flag.
No doctors, no. Medical researchers or experts, I assume, on the board.
That's right. No.
Yeah.
Well, and no women either. Only men.
Now, what do you make of that?
I think that she, deep inside, I think she knew from an early stage that she was able to charm men, and she was able to get them to believe what she was saying, and that while she might get some women to also believe her, that there was a greater risk with women. And she didn't want to incur that risk. And so I think she stuck to men. She knew men were her audience. She had a way with men. And I'm not, you know, insinuating anything inappropriate other than she was smart, attractive, young, really charismatic and smart, and she managed to convince men, you know, that what she was telling them was true, and she managed to get them engaged, and she managed to get them to champion her.
As the story unfolds in the book, there's another red flag, at least to a reader, and that is the amount of secrecy at Theranos. The secrecy seems almost pretty excessive, where you have people coming to work on machines, but they can't see anything else in the lab. There was the use of lawsuits against anybody who suggested saying anything negative about the company, non-disclosure agreements. Now, I assume some of that's part of Silicon Valley, but was their secrecy excessive at Theranos?
Right. I mean, the non-disclosure agreements are definitely common in Silicon Valley, and there is concern at all Silicon Valley companies, about leaking, letting technology and patented information leak. But this was really taking it to a whole new level. And the reason was that, you know, part of it was a lie. And so I think Elizabeth and Sonny were as secretive as they were because they were trying to prevent the truth from getting out. And in fact, the truth, the fact that they weren't really using proprietary technology, that they had hacked another company's machines, that wasn't even known by most of the workforce inside the company. The only people who knew about those shenanigans were the people who worked in one of the lab rooms, and those people had to get their fingerprint scans approved to get in those rooms, and anyone who wasn't approved for working in that one particular lab room didn't know that they were cheating with the laboratory instruments. So when my first story was published in late 2015, a lot of the 800 or might have been even 1,000 employees who worked for the company then, a lot of them thought that the journal's reporting was inaccurate and wrong because they didn't know the truth of what was going on in that lab room.
So how did you get tipped off as a reporter to this story?
I had a source who was a pathologist who saw a story about Elizabeth Holmes in late 2014 in the New Yorker magazine. And he was, from the get-go, adamant that what she claimed she had achieved wasn't possible. And he went on, after reading that New Yorker piece, to write a skeptical item on his blog. And someone who was an antagonist of Elizabeth Holmes read that blog item. It was someone who had been involved in patent litigation with her. And that person got in touch with this pathologist and told him he was onto something. And then the pathologist passed this sort of third-hand tip on to me. And I started digging, and within a few weeks was able to make contact with former employees, one in particular who had been head of the lab at Theranos and who had just left the company. And he knew where all the skeletons were buried. So he was an invaluable source, and I pretty much couldn't have done it without him.
So the question I have is, and you've described this in the book, is, you know, Walgreens comes on as a partner. How was Theranos able to mask the fact that their product didn't work to the point where Walgreens says, yep, we're going to put this in our stores?
Right. I mean, that's one of the craziest parts of the story. There's a chapter actually about this. I think it's chapter 6 of the book. In late 2010, when Walgreens is contemplating entering into a partnership with Theranos, they hire a lab consultant named Kevin Hunter. And Kevin Hunter, over the ensuing year and a half, becomes embedded in Walgreens. He works out of Walgreens' Deerfield, Illinois offices, and he travels with Walgreens executives several times to Palo Alto to meet Elizabeth and Sonny and to speak with them. And very early on, he starts to smell a rat, and he tries to alert his higher-ups at Walgreens. And the amazing thing is that Elizabeth and Sonny managed to muzzle him by objecting his participation in meetings and in conference calls. And so they get him excluded from all the meetings, and his warnings fall on deaf ears. And so you have this situation where Walgreens had a lab consultant that it had hired to look after its own interests that it ignored.
And you describe in the book these elaborate links they would do. They would have a demonstration, and they actually rig things up to show slow progress, but too slow for them to actually sit around and wait for the results. And they said, oh, well, we'll get this worked out. And then they send them results.
Right. That was one anecdote where they had the a writer from Fortune magazine, Roger Parloff, come and watch a demonstration at the offices of Theranos' law firm in New York City, Boies Schiller Flexner. And there were two Minilab devices. Minilab was the last iteration, the last prototype of the Theranos technology. And Roger Parloff had his finger pricked, and then the sample got put in the machine, and the machine started whirring. And the dial on the digital interface of the machine showed that the test progress was going really slow. And so he waited around about half an hour, but then he had to go back to work. And what had happened is when he left, a technician stopped the machine and realized that a piece of software that Sonny had ordered one of the engineers to write had been triggered, and that software was triggered when there was a malfunction with the device. And instead of showing an error on the user interface, it just showed a slowing dial, and it showed that the test progress was slowing. And so it was a way to mask an error, and an error had in fact occurred during that demo.
Well, there's a term in Silicon Valley. It's known as vaporware. This seems like this was classic vaporware. But as you write in the book, this Theranos was not a tech company. It was medical tech. What difference does that make in this story?
Well, it's a huge difference. The culture in Silicon Valley is to what they call, the verb they use is iterate, which is to, which is to say you put out a product even if it's not completely ready, and then and usually it's a software product or it's a smartphone app, and then you beam updates to it so that by the fifth or sixth it's pretty much perfected. And that culture, which is a software culture, has permeated Silicon Valley since the 70s, early 80s. The problem is that Elizabeth Holmes' company was a medical company more than it was a computer company. And there was software in the device, but the important part of the device was medical instruments. And you can't iterate with a medical instrument because doctors and patients are going to be relying on it to make very important healthcare decisions, some of them life or death decisions. Which is why the healthcare industry is the most regulated industry in the world. There's a reason for that. So the culture of iterating and of moving fast and of breaking things, which I think is a phrase we owe to Mark Zuckerberg, is not a culture that you want to espouse in the area of medicine.
Well, John Carreyrou, thanks very much for your time. It's a fascinating read, Bad Blood. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
John Carreyrou is an investigative reporter for The Wall Street Journal and the author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. The book is published in softcover by Vintage. He'll be a guest of Magic City Books and OU Tulsa in a special event, a ticketed event, Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock at OU Tulsa. Details at magiccitybooks.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.